WNBC and WNBC-FM, New York. Who is responsible for pedestrian traffic accidents? Is it the driver? Is it the person on foot? Safety authorities say that both share an equal responsibility. Therefore, why not do your part to save a life? Because the life you save might be yours.
A new motion picture, The Sealed Verdict, made by Paramount Pictures and taken from the best-selling novel of the same name by Lionel Shapiro, is the target for attack and defense on The Author Meets the Critics. We invite you now to listen to a critical preview of a movie to be released next month, a movie which is bound to be discussed for many months to come. Here, for example, are two typical opinions. First, Mr. Louis Neiser, well-known attorney and author.
While I find the motion picture is exciting and entertaining, I find it very different from the book. The book argues in a none too subtle way for a soft peace with Germany. Its whole focus is whether there is a technical failure of proof concerning the guilt of a Nazi war criminal, whereas the focus ought to be that so many hundreds of thousands of Nazi criminals are getting by without even trial.
And here with an entirely different point of view is another critic, well-known commentator and NBC personality, Ben Grauer.
The central idea which I find in this film is that the basic principles of democratic justice must not be abandoned, whatever the pressure. This picture shows that ultimately the clash between the Nazi idea and the American idea is whether mankind lives by law or by his personal lust for power. History from the caveman to Hitler shows that mankind doesn't move forward that way.
Obviously, we're in for a battle about a movie. And so it's time to call upon our peacemaker and moderator, your regular chairman, John K.M. McCaffrey.
Good afternoon, everyone. This is United Nations Day, one day set aside in the year to remind you that every day, all year, the United Nations is doing the job of maintaining world peace. We think it particularly appropriate on this day to discuss The Sealed Verdict, which is a best-selling novel by Lionel Shapiro, made the subject of a new Paramount movie soon to be released. We think it appropriate because this is the story of post-war Germany, the most difficult problem facing the United Nations today. In a little while, you'll hear Lionel Shapiro as he meets his critics face to face. But first, let me set the scene and tell you what The Sealed Verdict is all about. It all takes place at the post-war trials of Nazi criminals in Nuremberg. The principal character is young Major Robert Lawson, played by Ray Milland in the picture. Lawson is chief prosecutor in the trial of the German general Otto Steigmann. It was Steigmann who was charged with having ordered a massacre of defenseless hostages. Lawson's evidence is slim, and though he wins his case and the general is condemned to hang, there lingers in the prosecutor's mind a terrible doubt. Was the evidence enough? Had he really proved the general's guilt? We would like to bring you at this point an actual recording from the motion picture, The Sealed Verdict, taken from the movie soundtrack. It's a scene between Ray Milland, who plays Lawson, the prosecutor, and Florence Marley, who plays the beautiful Frenchwoman, Tammy. Tammy was a witness at the trial in defense of the German general, and she has protested his innocence. As the scene opens, Major Lawson, anxious to get the truth from Tammy if he can, brings her to his room. She speaks first.
Do you always conduct business this way, Major?
No. Usually I serve champagne.
I must admit your technique is more subtle than Captain Kinsella's and more dangerous.
Well, you can relax because I'm planning nothing more dangerous than a few questions.
I'm afraid I don't believe you.
No? Why not, mademoiselle?
The scene is too well known. The handsome young officer. The sinister woman who consulted with Germans in Paris.
Suppose you let me set the scene. This officer fears he's made a mistake that'll cost the man his life. And one of the clues to this mistake is a certain witness.
I'm a clue?
Didn't you say Steigmann was innocent?
But you refuse to believe me.
That may have been one of my mistakes.
But what more can I do?
Well, you can help unravel a few items. For instance, I'd like to know why Steigmann risked his career to keep your father out of prison.
Our families were friends in Switzerland. And besides, I asked him.
Yes, that I know. But what I don't know is why you came to the trial. You must have realized it would antagonize your people.
Yes, they will probably put me on trial.
Then why?
He did me a favor I will remember as long as I live. I tried to repay his kindness.
I should think your father would have been the one to come.
My father is dead.
I'm sorry.
I suppose I sound foolish.
No. No, you sound pretty nice. But it still doesn't quite add up, not from the Steigman angle. There must have been something in it for him.
He received nothing.
It's hard to believe.
What would you find easy to believe, Major?
That you were in love with him in Paris and that you still are.
And if so?
That would explain your coming here, your belief in his innocence, and your request for permission to see him.
You have an unpleasant mind.
No more unpleasant than the minds of women who collaborated with their country's enemies.
I should have known how it would be from this afternoon. It was foolish for me to come to listen to you.
Wait a minute.
No.
Look, I was off base.
Let me go.
Please, I apologize. Listen. You want to save Steigman and I want the truth. That's all I want, whether it helps him or hangs him.
You have just heard a scene from The Sealed Verdict between Ray Milland playing Major Lawson and Florence Marley playing the French girl, Tammy. Perhaps we should tell a little bit more about the story of The Sealed Verdict. Major Lawson is carried away by the sincerity of the French girl. He becomes convinced that justice will miscarry through his fault if General Steigman hangs. Everything combines to increase Lawson's confusion. His own commanding officer shows him evidence that Tammy is a traitor. One of his witnesses turns out to have concealed an important fact. The people of Nuremberg are staging demonstrations. Rumor is rife that, after all, Steigman will not hang. And, of course, Lawson is now in love with Tammy so that he doubts himself. In desperation, Lawson makes one last effort to unearth the truth. On the eve of the hanging, he visits Steigman in his cell. And here we would like to bring you another scene from the movie with Ray Milland as Lawson and John Hoyt as General Steigman. Major Lawson speaks first.
Sit down, General.
Have you a light?
Are you permitted to smoke here?
No, outside only, but since...
I'm sorry.
What do you want of me?
The day you were sentenced, General, you made a speech maintaining your innocence.
That is correct.
A soldier obeying the orders of his superiors, striking hard blows, wounded on the battlefield, I was quite impressed. Until I ran across some documents.
Yes.
One was a note congratulating you on the Lehmreich massacre, signed by Adolf Hitler. Then there was an accident naval order. Like the others, it authorized the commanding officer to execute any non-Germans at his discretion. Sentimental souvenirs a soldier couldn't bear to destroy. I'm amazed you bothered to lie. A soldier would have said, yes, I've done these things, and they've been on my conscience.
I would like to know where you got them.
Your mother.
That was a nice maternal gesture. You're wasting your time. My mother gave you nothing, because there are no such documents. Am I right? I thought so. You make this clumsy trap because of your conscience, your democratic conscience. Yet you will never know. Guilty or innocent, you will always wonder. I've defeated you, my friend.
I'd hardly say that. Not from in here.
This is nothing. Because in the end, I win. I will become in the new Germany a name like Hitler. Like Goering. There was never sentimental about my duty. I killed as I had to kill, without fear, without remorse. I was a German of the elite Germans, of the Hitler Germans. I am not afraid to die. That's the difference. You are soft. Afraid to die and afraid to kill. I will die as I have killed. Your own airmen, 10 of them I had shot, and escaped English prisoners, and Russians, and Poles, and Frenchmen, by my orders. And we will rise again. Auf der ganzen Welt werden wir die Untermenschen ausrotten.
And now you have an idea of what The Sealed Verdict is about. It's time now for the author to engage his critics. Mr. Neiser, will you begin the engagement of Mr. Grauer?
Well, after the First World War, the Allies drew up a list of 1,500 war criminals to be tried. Out of 12 million soldiers, only 1,500. But you know actually how many were tried? 14. And you know how many were found guilty? 4. And they received small sentences of several years' jail. Now this time, after the Second World War, we made a resolution to do better, but have we? At the Nuremberg trial, only 22 Nazis were tried and only 12 were condemned to die. There's been amnesty for hundreds of thousands of the Hitler youth. They've been getting by, well, literally with murder. Now, under these circumstances, our author, Mr. Shapiro, who has written a facile and exciting book, and the motion picture, which isn't very much like the book, is even better and much more exciting. Nevertheless, our author has devoted himself to the proposition of a struggle of conscience in an American prosecutor's mind, because he thinks that though the Nazi war criminal is guilty, you've just heard him speak, he makes a confession in the picture at the end, though he's guilty and he knows he's guilty, he has a tremendous struggle with his conscience because perhaps a piece of evidence that he's submitted might have been technically inadmissible. Now, I say that subtly this book argues for a soft German peace. It argues for the confusion which Mr. Grauer, I think, has stated in his opening statement, a confusion that democratic principle requires us to be soft and generous with Nazi war criminals. I'm a lawyer. I don't want to violate democratic principles or international law. But I say that there's a great deal of confusion about this, and let me illustrate it from the book. May I, Mr. McCaffrey?
Yes.
Just a few very brief illustrations. For example, at page 143, the American prosecutor asks Rodal, who is a Czech, and incidentally, the villain of this book is a Czech. He's been tortured by the Nazis, so he's gone half mad, and now he's turned to blackmail and whatnot. He's the evil character. Even Steigman comes out with some courage, as you've just heard on this recording. But the nasty and very evil character is a Czech. I don't like that kind of relationship, incidentally. But then this American prosecutor asks the Czech, why do you torture Frau Steigman, she's the wife of the Nazi war criminal. Why Rodal? Rodal's the name of the Czech. Why? She is a poor woman. She has suffered enough. You see, the Czechs haven't suffered, really. It's the wife of the Nazi criminal he's concerned about. Or take another illustration. At page 209 of the book, the heroine, who is this French girl, and incidentally, the book pictures her as having made the supreme sacrifice of her honor. She has become the mistress of the general, the Nazi war criminal, in order to save her lover. And she considers her duty so great, her obligation so great for that favor that he's done her, that when he's tried as a war criminal, she actually volunteers. It's not part of the deal with him. She volunteers.
Well, Mr. Grauer is getting very restless here, Mr.
Neiser. Well, I'm not exactly restless, Mr. Neiser, but you make the picture and the book sound so exciting, although you don't agree with them, that I think I want to go back and see it again.
I'm for that.
May I, just at a halfway mark, take exception to a few of the principles you've expressed or the statements you've made? You say that I'm adding a confusion to the point of the book by suggesting that the application of democratic principles of law include enacting upon Germany or delivering unto Germany a soft and generous peace. I said nothing about about being soft. I said the hard, most rigid, and most hard adherence to age-old concepts of justice, to you as which you as a lawyer must recognize of utmost importance.
Well, Ben, may I ask you a question?
Just a minute, Mr. Neiser.
I'm just going to complete that one point, Louis.
Go ahead.
When Steigman finally agrees and confesses under the duress and pressure of the ultimate truth in the death chamber and says, yes, I did kill those American flyers, the heart, the questing heart of our hero is finally at peace. He knows that he can send this man to his death without being a willful judger of his guilt, but that the confession has come from the man's very lips. What could be harder, what could be more exacting and Spartan than a dedication to principles which say, I will not violate these principles, although I hate this man, my right to judge him is not more important than justice.
Ben, I know your heart is in the right place, but let me see if I can't win over your judgment.
Okay.
The book pictures the prosecutor as saying that he knows that Steigman, the Nazi war criminal, is guilty. He says so. He says, I know he's guilty as dash. I won't repeat it on radio. But he says he's worried that one of the witnesses, this Rodal, may have testified untruthfully. So it's a technical failure of evidence which has already been accepted. The verdict has already been granted, which worries him. But then he goes to the chamber, the death chamber, and when the Nazi confesses, incidentally, that's inadmissible, he obtained it under circumstances which aren't admissible in court, and it isn't given in court, then he's satisfied. Now, if you're going to stick to the very hyper-technical rules of evidence, which I know a little bit about, Ben,
that's a great deal.
Then the confession in the prison should no more have relieved him of his struggle of conscience than the testimony prior thereto. The real point of the matter is, Ben, is this. The point of the matter is that here we are giving a fine work of art to the proposition that perhaps we have sinned on a very high but technical question of law with respect to a man who has murdered hundreds of thousands of people. He confesses, incidentally, and who is pictured in this book as having made a mistress out of this fine French girl and ruined her life. And here we are, a whole book devoted to the proposition that maybe he's going to hang when he isn't technically proven guilty, though he is guilty.
Well, I think that the one person who is best able to answer your accusations is our author. And was this your concept, Mr. Shapiro?
Well, I've been enjoying the discussion between Mr. Grauer and Mr. Neiser because I felt somewhat like a deity. Both of them are arguing about what I wrote, and I'm really the only person who knows what I wrote.
Well, that's a condemnation of your book, if true, Mr. Shapiro, but go ahead.
Will you make a confession then, Lionel?
Well, I'll make a confession completely. First, that cover one point that Mr. Neiser made about the soft peace. I think the short answer to that is that the German war criminals on trial in the first chapter of the book and in the first scene of the picture, and in the last scene of the picture and in the last chapter of the book, he hangs. Now, if you think that is a soft piece that portrays a soft piece for Germans, I beg to disagree.
Just a minute, Mr. Neiser. Just a minute, Mr. Neiser. Go on, Mr.
Excuse me.
Then there's the whole conception of how I wrote Sealed Verdict and why I wrote Sealed Verdict. There's no pun intended here, but I wrote it out of misgivings rather than out of convictions. I attended the Nuremberg trial. I attended a great many minor war crimes trials in Germany as a foreign correspondent. And I heard the accusations against the Germans that they are employed war as an instrument of national policy, employed war for serving political ends, for solving political problems. At Nuremberg particularly, I saw we and the Russians sit in judgment over the Germans and accuse them of this. And as time went on, as the situation in the world is developing now, we are now at least talking up a war against the Russians. And that gave me misgivings. I mean, how worthy were we to sit in judgment over the Germans when we haven't banished war as a means, as an instrument for settling international disputes?
Mr. Grauer. First, Mr. Grauer.
Immediately the thought that springs to mind to come to Lionel, to author's aid, saying how worthy am I to sit on judgment, the only thing that can make one worthy in this struggle between two masses of people is a dedication to ideals.
Exactly.
And the thing that makes us worthy to judge the German is that he was dedicated only to physical power lust and not to continuing verities, continuing truth.
Mr. McCaffrey, I haven't said anything as condemnatory about this view as Mr. Shapiro has about his own book. We're not talking up a war against Russia. Russia, in the same spirit that Hitler has started a dynamic expansionism to create a war, is the one that's creating trouble. And we might as well later on be just as soft with the Russians and worry about technical proof there. Let me quote one word from your book which answers your first proposition. You quote the heroine as saying, and the hero approves it, the prosecutor approves it, the weak have become strong, that means we. This is page 112, Mr. Shapiro. The weak have become strong, and the strong have become vengeful, and the vengeful have become greedy, and the greedy have become cruel. And there is no peace, the world has learned nothing. In other words, we who have won the war have become greedy and cruel, and at several other places you call us just as guilty, just as evil as the Nazis, for example.
May I interrupt you? You're now talking about something I wrote.
That's right.
When I said we, that they
weak
died, the weak have become strong, and the
that
strong
means
have become
the victorious allies.
No, I referred to
whom?
Other. I referred to Eastern Europe there.
Well, if you refer to Eastern Europe, I don't want to debate Russia with you, but I think that's even more evil. But how about page 209, where you say, Steigman was evil, and I believe the world in judging him was also evil, just as evil. In other words, we who judge the Nazi war criminals are just as evil as they.
You're taking words now out of a character. She was a disillusioned person. This is an individual case. She's the heroine.
She's the heroine in the sense of the love interest and affection that springs between her and the army officer.
Well, if that's
the advocate, I'm still talking. The advocate of ideas. The man who expresses what Shapiro, our author, seated at this table, wanted to say about truths, not about the relation of love between these two people, which is a sentimental and heart-winning tale, but not what we're talking about here, is this statement that I'll take from page 115, Mr. Neiser.
Go ahead.
We have our central hero, Lawson, speaking, and he says, "The dark tragedy of patriotism is that men will fight for their country rather than for the principles that made their country beloved to them."
Well,
the Germans fought for principles, abandoned their principles, and fought for blind nationalism. You've gotten us far off into a discussion of a possibility of war with Russia. How would we be able to fight if that dreadful, black, furious day ever came? Would we be able to fight those people if we abandoned our principles and fought only with the weakness of material strength?
Ben, I'm not proposing that we abandon any principles, and you know that. Let's see if any of your explanations hold water. You've quoted 115, Ben.
That's right.
Look at 113, which precedes that. And immediately after the speech in which we're supposed to be as guilty
I've
as they are...
I've never had quite such a reading session on the author meets the critic in the 6 years
Deals
I've been doing it.
Well,
let me quote these four words. That's all I'll read. Immediately after this offensive statement to me that we're as evil as they are and that the weak have become cruel, the author says, now you're speaking, Mr. Shapiro, don't put the blame on any of your characters now. Her words made sense. Her words made sense, these words which she utters, which makes us as evil as the Nazis. And do you wish to make a parallel between our action towards Russia and Hitler's action towards the rest of the world? Aren't we on the just and moral side and trying to resist Russian aggression? And isn't that the very point of this? If we become so soft as a democracy that we can't act with vigor, then aren't we abandoning rather than holding to those principles?
I know, but you continue, Louis, you continue to say the weak have become strong, the strong have become vengeful, etc., as referring to us. I say no. I say it refers to Russia.
Well, Lionel, may I ask you this? Do you happen to know that today in Germany, Dr. Wolf Witzleben, who actually helped to build the concentration camps and the extermination chambers, and who was convicted by a denazification court of being a war criminal, is today peacefully the head of the Siemens Electrical Company under English aegis in Germany? Do you know that Johann Bendit, an engineer who actually built the extermination camps, is working now peacefully as an engineer in that camp? And I have quoted in a book that I have written about a half a dozen famous Nazi war criminals who are now leaders of industry under our aegis. Do you think we've been too severe upon them?
Just a minute, Mr. Neiser. Are you suggesting that because our justice has not worked out as perfectly as we would like, that we should abandon the principles under which that justice was created?
No, of course not. I think that democracy can be strong in enforcing peace, and that in enforcing justice, we needn't be lost in an exterminable range of technicalities. I say that it doesn't strengthen democracy to let war criminals go free. On the contrary, it will aid in enforcing peace if we enforce the war crime verdicts accurately and if we don't write books challenging our own conscience because we've convicted some of the Nazi war criminals.
No one says that we should give a soft peace to Germany or a soft future to German war criminals. The key to what you said was the word criminals. When by just due process of law these persons are proved to be guilty, then the swiftest retribution must be brought
to them. Well, if due process...
But with all of Europe, which I recently returned from, I talked with people in Berlin and Frankfurt 2 or 3 weeks ago. I saw the hidden glee with which they observed the release of Ilse Koch, the woman who is a parallel to the Steigmann whom we talk about here.
Is that a point for me, Ben?
That is a point for you. I'm arguing for past your point to the ultimate point. One or two or three Kochs may be released, and a miscarriage of justice which we feel sentimentally may occur. But if we release the principles by which we govern the whole occupation of Germany and do it not on evidential rules and on impassioned rules, but on rules of blood and passion, we're descending to a Nazi level.
Ben, I'm not arguing for that. I'm in full agreement with that. But I say that if only four were convicted at the end of the last war and sentenced to 4 years in jail, and only 12 were convicted to death this time, how are you abandoning the rules of democracy to be a blood purge?
As a matter of fact, in this book, that's what we're concerned with. Mr. Spiro.
Well, finally, I get some little time on the air here. Now, on the Ilse Koch case, which I think is a very good parallel here, my quarrel is not so much with Clay or the reviewing board that commuted the Koch sentence. It is with the prosecutors who brought in the cases against Frau Koch. And those cases haven't stood up against the scrutiny of the reviewing board. I've got no sympathy with Ilse Koch. I would like to see her in jail for the rest of her life if they can't get around to hanging her. I think she is guilty.
I think she'd make a lovely lampshade.
I think she'd make a wonderful lampshade. I think it's important that she be punished.
I won't go along with that. I'm going to stop right here. I don't think any human being would ever make a lovely lampshade.
It was a jest.
But I think it is more important that a clean, foolproof case be brought against her, one that will stand up against the scrutiny of the reviewing board and against, more importantly, the test of history.
Lionel, from what I have read of that case, there was more than ample evidence to execute her 10 times over. But there is a perfect illustration of the kind of confusion that arises when you insist upon hyper-technical evidence and a man who isn't even a lawyer, General Clay, decides that perhaps some of this evidence wasn't adequate to the occasion.
Well, I can assure you that General Clay has many, many legal aides in the JAG division. I can assure you that General Clay, heading the occupation, has at his hands touch... the infinite variety.
And isn't it important that they correct their thinking so that they don't think the way you two gentlemen are?
No. May I make one more statement?
Yes, if I can make one.
I want something terribly important that is the crux, I think, of the whole book and of the Ilse Koch case, too. The importance of having clean legal evidence is this. We live in a confused world. For the thinking, the intelligent, the liberal mind, this is a stormy passage in current history. We find our ally of 1941, Soviet Russia, has now become our potential enemy. We find that our potential enemy of 1941, Franco-Spain, is now being touted as a valuable ally. Everywhere, events of the past 10 years are covered in disillusion and doubt. In this kind of period, I think we must return for guidance to the old principles, the historical concept of freedom as of 1776, the biblical concept of compassion, the Anglo-Saxon concept of justice. We must apply this to the case of Ilse Koch. She as a person is not important. What is important is the concept of justice by which we punish her. Let's prove her guilty by all means and give her the punishment she deserves, but let us be guided by our own straightforward conception of what constitutes conviction. Ilse Koch is on trial before American justice, and at the same time, and more importantly, American justice is on trial before the world.
Mr. Grower.
And tying in with what Lionel has said, we can't hope to rescue the people who have had 15 or 10 years of Hitler. I've spoken to those Germans. They're pretty well convinced that they were right. But the social democrats in France, the anti-fascists in Italy, the numb, stunned people in Czechoslovakia, they're looking to us for guidance, for leadership, out of the very confusion that Lionel's spoken of.
And looking for us to leadership are the hundreds of thousands of victims who cannot speak anymore, the ones that these men killed. And if you gentlemen would spend half of your good time and sympathy and compassion for the victims of these people and the nations who were the victims of these people, rather than for these imaginary grievances of technical evidence, you would serve a much greater cause and would strengthen democracy, as I know you both wish to do.
I am amazed, Mr. Neiser, to hear a lawyer talking so in such low terms of technicalities. I thought that's the way lawyers made their living. But at any rate, to our radio audience, we can say that this discussion very well illustrates how differently people can see a movie and read a book. Mr. Grower and Mr. Shapiro, I think, were concerned primarily with the innocence of Major Lawson, and Mr. Neiser was concerned with the guilt of General Steigman. I think that both are problems germane to the sealed verdict, and in a very short time, you will be able to go to your movie house and to see the movie. And, of course, the book is even now available to you. And now, here is Bob Sherry to tell you what lies ahead on The Author Meets the Critics.
Next week, due to a special pre-election broadcast, The Author Meets the Critics will not be on the air. But we would like to remind our listeners to be sure to be with us on Sunday, November 7th, when Burl Ives, America's greatest balladeer, will be on hand to discuss his new autobiography, entitled The Wayfaring Stranger. And we hope you'll join us, too, in the weeks that follow, when our authors include Fred Hartley, co-author of the Taft-Hartley Labor Act, Congressman Saul Bloom, Eric Johnston, and many others. Remember, our next broadcast will be heard on Sunday afternoon, November 7th, when Burl Ives meets his critics. And now back to John McCaffrey.
Before closing, I'd like to thank you, Lionel Shapiro, for coming here today to discuss the sealed verdict, and to thank you, Louis Neiser and Ben Grower, for joining us. And special thanks to Paramount Pictures for allowing us the recreation of scenes from their new motion picture, The Sealed Verdict, soon to be released. This is John McCaffrey saying good afternoon for The Author Meets the Critics.
The Author Meets the Critics is produced by Martin Stone, directed by Lee Jones. This is Bob Sherry speaking. This program came to you today from the RCA Exhibition Hall. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.